All right. So matter we have up this morning, docket number 81782, State versus Adams. Counsel, are we ready to proceed? Okay. And would you like to reserve any time?
3 minutes.
All right.
May it please the court, Alexander Chen on behalf of the appellant State of Nevada in this matter. Vinnie Adams was declared incompetent without the possibility of restoration from charges related to shaking his two-week-old baby, charges that have left the victim blind and subject to permanent neurological damage. Now, the record in this case has certain facts that really aren't in dispute with regards to what happened. We know, based upon the evaluations that were given, as well as the reports, that Mr. Adams was capable of many things. He was capable enough to have a baby. He was capable enough and competent enough to live independently with his child and his significant other. He was competent enough to have somebody take a driver's test so that he could drive. And he drives among us here in Nevada. He was competent enough to realize that there was something wrong with his baby, to drive to the Suncoast Casino where he was going to get his wife and where they could then go to the hospital. He was competent enough to speak with police about the incidents and the shaking that led up to this case. These are just a few of the things that Mr. Adams was competent enough to do. Yet in the eyes of the district court, at this point, as it stands today, he is not competent enough to face charges for his actions. Now, in this particular case, respondent counsel and I agree on a number of things. However, from the outset, I want to emphasize that this case is not about me or the state asking this court to second guess the district court decision. We understand that normally the trial court is in the position to resolve factual discrepancies. And here there were some discrepancies as to the doctor's testimony. But what we are asking you to do is find that as a matter of law, the district court applied an incorrect standard that was based upon an incorrect standard and was based upon something beyond what Dusky stands for.
Is that what you argued in your opening brief?
I think we argued both things, Justice Pickering. There obviously was a lot of evidence to support the fact that there was a discrepancy among the...
Right, but you identify the standard as abuse of discretion, to be more pointed. So yes. Are you saying this is an abuse of discretion review?
We do think it was abuse of discretion review based upon what the district court relied on and what the evidence was in this particular case.
So do you concede that we should evaluate her decision for abuse of discretion?
I do believe that, Your Honor, and we have written that. I apologize if I said it otherwise.
Yeah.
But we do agree that or believe that this was a manifest abuse of discretion by the district court in using the standard that it used.
So you're putting the legal error, you're saying legal error amounts to abuse of discretion, and therefore that's your argument?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. So one of the questions that this court asked for when it came to the supplemental briefing was who carries the burden? And it's my position that from the evidence in this case, I don't believe that it's necessarily just the burden of proof issue that we had here. I don't believe that if you change the burden of proof, it would matter because based upon our position, it was clear that the defendant was competent to stand trial.
Let's take out the other three witnesses and just focus. Let's say the only witness was the doctor that the defense put forward.
Yes.
What would be your position if that were the only witness in this case?
And that's actually what I'd like to focus on because of this court's appellate review of the district court's decision. And if you just base it on her report, Dr. Jones-Forrester's report, I would say you'd come to the same conclusion that the defendant had a rational understanding of the charges, of what court was, and of his ability to aid counsel. Now, I would agree with whether it was Dr. Jones-Forrester, whether it was the three Stein doctors, that The defendant absolutely had mental deficiencies. I'm not here to argue that he was an ideal defendant, or that he was the most savvy defendant, or that he was the smartest defendant, or that he understood every possible thing that could happen, whether it was in court, whether it was a conversation with his attorney. But what I am here to argue is that he had a rational understanding of those. And if you look at Dr. Jones Forrester's actual report, she goes
go into that report, though. I mean, if we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard, are we not second guessing the district court's determination of its credibility findings of its experts? I mean, in every evidentiary hearing in these competency, you have the state's experts and you have the defense experts. Aren't you asking us to second guess the district court's judge's determination of who they find more credible as an expert?
I don't think, well, what I'm arguing, Justice Silver, is that I do think that this court has the ability to do it based upon the clear evidence here that is contrary to what the standard is. This court can reverse an abuse of discretion, and our argument is, yes, the district court abused its discretion when it relied solely on this evidence, which even if you believe Dr. Jones Forrester's report, we still should come to the conclusion that he had a rational understanding of the things involved. One of the main things that Dr. Jones Forrester says in her report is that he'll have problems with complex and nuanced issues as they arise. But she does not say that he doesn't understand it. In fact, in this case, she says that he understands the charges, but he could have difficulties conveying some of the things to the attorney. Now there I would argue, well, again, that could be true of many defendants. One of the things that Dr. Jones Forrester is concerned about is, well, the relationship between the attorney and the defendant is so unbalanced because of his deference to the attorney that he wouldn't express himself. But isn't that true of so many things? How many attorneys have we seen, or how many cases have we seen, where a defendant relies upon the counsel of his attorney? How many people rely upon what their doctor tells them, even if they don't feel that it's right, or even if they have concerns about it?
So, Mr. Chin, yes. I may interrupt you, and I apologize, but Justice Pickering rightly asks you about the legal test here. It seems like the testimony that you're referring to, offered by Dr. Jones Forrester on that score, is unsupported by Dusky and the legal authorities that determine the test for incompetency in this kind of setting. Would you comment about that?
Yeah, I do think
that seems to be the focus of the district court's determination that competency could not be restored, which to me is kind of the center problem in this case.
And it is for us too, Justice Hardesty, because if this were a mere competency hearing where we had to delay trial, yes, there would be inconveniences involved, but ultimately a trial would theoretically happen if he was restored to competency. The problem here, and the greatest consequence, is that despite multiple doctors indicating that he was that there was a substantial probability that he could be restored, the district court found that he simply couldn't be, and relied upon this report, which included things that go well beyond what Dusky requires.
So I think it would be helpful, especially for your opponent to comment about, is what is it about the Jones-Forrester testimony that exceeded, from the state's point of view, the bounds of consideration allowed by Dusky and related cases?
I think
it is kind of a mixed legal factual problem.
I agree, Justice Hardesty, and I would say that where I think that report is faulty is in a couple of things. I would argue that the fact that she put such an emphasis on his neuropsychological capacity, his IQ, those type of things.
Well, his IQ, she found it to be 56, correct?
She found it, I believe, 58, and then I believe that some of the other doctors, Dr. Rowley, I believe, felt that it might be adjusted based upon some factors, but certainly he has a lower
IQ. But there is no other number than 58.
There is no other number, but here we're talking about what do the Stein doctors normally do in order to evaluate someone under Dusky. Certainly, this is additional information that Dr. Jones Forrester wanted to do or that she was hired to do, and she performed that. And she created an IQ or believes that the IQ is somewhere in that range. But as she even says, IQ itself doesn't mean that someone's going to be unable to be restored to competence. So here,
let me push you on what Justice Hardesty was asking and what would be helpful to me. What in her findings, in Judge Bell's findings, not the doctor's testimony, but what in her findings do you think constituted legal error and misapplication of Dusty and the statute in Nevada that expresses it?
Well, first, I would argue that despite the fact that the statute 178.425 subsection 5 talks about substantial probability that they can be restored, she found that there was no possibility at all that they could be restored. So versus the probability standard, she said, based upon all the evidence that we have in this case, all the various evaluations, that there's simply no possibility that she could, that this individual could ever be restored to competency. And I do think that that's, and I don't know if the judge did that intentionally or if she did it just because it was a mistake between probability and possibility, but I feel that she's put even a higher bar on things where clearly the evidence doesn't support that there was no possibility that he could restore.
Well, it's difficult to evaluate what that decision making was because each of the two orders and the two cases are verbatim in that paragraph 100% when it references ability or without restoration. It's a very short summary paragraph for what I consider to be one of the more important issues that she decided. It doesn't appear that there's any analysis in there.
And most of her amended order is from direct quotes from Dr. Jones Forrester's report, not from any of the other evidence that was adduced by any of the other psychologists or psychiatrists that evaluated this particular defendant. So based upon...
Mr. Chin, why is that wrong? Why isn't it within the purview of the judge to determine what weight to give to the testimony in front of it? Why would one of the doctors be punished for doing more? We say, well, you can't do more tests. So if the Stein doctors had done more tests to rebut that, we'd say, hey, that's too much. How can we step in between that judge's determination of weight? Can we really say that she abused her discretion?
I don't believe that more was necessarily the problem here, just distinguished, because one of the arguments, and I apologize, I can't remember if this was in this case or the other, but they argued that we were trying to say that we should have objected to relevancy based upon all this. And my position is we shouldn't have objected to relevancy of all this. This information was something the judge could consider, certainly. I think what Dr. Jones's Forrester's emphasis and the one adopted by the district court, though, is they took that emphasis on IQ alone and other neuropsychological evaluations and put so much emphasis on it as to go well beyond what Dusty stands for. And that's where my problem is that, yes, this individual had a low Q, but unfortunately in our criminal justice system, my assumption is that many people suffer from bad childhoods, poor education, psychological defects like we had in this case. But that's not what Dusky is about. And that's where the district court, I believe, abused its discretion.
So it's relevant. It's okay to consider it. She just considered it too much.
I think her only consideration, and even in looking at the brief amended order and the findings that she has, absolutely, Justice Kadich, she gave it a weight that goes well beyond what Dusty requires. And I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal if I may.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Justices, Deborah Westbrook appearing today on behalf of the respondent, Vinny Adams. The district court found Mr. Adams incompetent without the possibility of restoration after a competency challenge hearing where both the state and the defense presented conflicting expert opinions and the court resolved those conflicts in favor of the defense. The district court applied the correct legal standard from Dusky and NRS 178.400 to find Mr. Adams lacked the present ability to aid and assist counsel and to understand the nature and purpose of court proceedings. The district court also satisfied NRS 178.460 sub 4 sub D, which required a finding that Mr. Adams had no substantial probability of attaining competency in the foreseeable future. Now, as counsel pointed out, the court's finding actually went above and beyond that finding or that requirement, because the court found present incompetence without possibility of restoration. That's not an error. The court actually found something that was more than what that statute required. The factual findings that the court made are entitled to deference and cannot be overturned unless there is not substantial evidence in the record to support them. Now, the court asked for supplemental briefing on the issue of preponderance or what the burden of proof would be and who bears the burden. I can address those issues later if the court is interested, because I don't know that those issues necessarily affect the determination in this particular case. So I want to start with a discussion of why the record contains substantial evidence to support the district court's finding and why the court can affirm without deciding those two issues. In the record, we have evidence, the defense presented testimony from Dr. Sharon Jones-Forster. She's a clinical neuropsychologist, and she testified about two separate evaluations that she undertook. The first was a neuropsych eval in February of 2019, and the second was a competency evaluation that she undertook in May of 2020, where she observed Mr. Adams interacting with his attorney and with a social worker. The neuropsych exam revealed that Mr. Adams had an extremely low IQ of 58. He had academic skills at the kindergarten and first grade level, functional illiteracy, significant difficulties with memory, and vulnerability to missing and misunderstanding information. She diagnosed Mr. Adams with moderate intellectual disability, significant neurocognitive deficits, and significant learning disabilities, all of which were not amenable to restoration and were lifelong conditions. Dr. Jones-Forster also testified about the results of her May 2020 competency evaluation, where she found Mr. Adams presently incompetent for the same two reasons that were articulated by the court in its decision, in its amended order. So the basis for those findings as to whether he presently had a rational and factual understanding of court proceedings, Dr. Jones-Forster testified that by May of 2020, he had forgotten virtually everything that he had appeared to have learned at Stein about court proceedings. The state's experts had not seen Mr. Adams for 7 months at the time of the challenge hearing. They agreed that there could be slippage, and so the district court properly gave Dr. Jones-Forster's testimony about his present understanding greater weight. As to whether Mr. Adams could presently assist counsel, again, Dr. Jones-Forster had recently watched Mr. Adams interacting with his attorney, and she saw how difficult it was for him to understand the information that was being conveyed to him and remember the attorney's advice and understand what was going on.
Let me pause you for a moment. In their brief, they make comment that the slippage itself is demonstration of his ability to be restored to competence for purposes of standing trial. In other words, that he reached a higher level and then lost it. Could you comment on that?
Sure. And that was their opinion based on their belief that he didn't have these lifelong neuropsychological conditions. They believed that there was an IQ issue, but they did not agree with her other findings that he had significant neurocognitive deficits. And what Sharon Jones-Forster testified to was that she didn't believe that he was ever really competent when they had kind of gotten him to parrot back the things that he had parroted back when he was in Stein, because they're showing him pictures. You know, here's a smiley face for the defense attorney. Here's a frowny face for the DA. And he was able to, you know, kind of say what they wanted him to say at that point without really understanding it. So I think it's consistent that, you know, the fact of slippage doesn't mean that he necessarily ever had the competency within her understanding. And that's, I believe, what the court took into consideration what the court.
Let me ask you, Ms. Westbrook, along the lines of the question that Justice Hardesty had posed to Mr. Chen a moment ago, about what the state's position is on what Dr. Jones-Forster was doing in this idea of a kind of a heightened standard. So here's a really imperfect analogy, but if three teachers take elementary students to test math competency and ask them about multiplication tables, et cetera, right, and then another teacher comes along and says, let's do variable calculus, and says they're not competent in math. It seems to be that's what the state is saying, that Dr. Jones-Forster was asking variable calculus when the test under Dusky should be simple multiplication, addition, and subtraction kind of tables. So how is what she was doing? Because I don't think over and beyond is bad, right? Just because a doctor does more than other people do doesn't make it bad. It's just, do you do things that don't really relate to competency?
So I guess how I would answer that is Dusky established a legal test for competence. And again, that decision is very brief. It's like 200 and some odd words long. Right. And it said nothing about the types of psychiatric evidence that would be sufficient or that would be relevant or that would be, you know, usable in that matter. They didn't, the Dusky decision doesn't say you have to conduct an evaluation and evaluate these specific things in terms of, you know, what type of test a doctor could perform, because a court doesn't actually have to necessarily focus on a doctor's test at all. The judge is allowed to look at how the defendant is interacting in court. The judge can use, you know, their own observation. So it's not
a huge blend of objective and subjective.
Exactly. And so what I would say is that in Dusky, the Supreme Court actually recognized that there were doubts and ambiguities regarding the legal significance of psychiatric testimony. And so the court remanded to the district court for the district court to make that determination. The case doesn't say anything about what evidence is necessary to demonstrate that each, you know, that the defendant meets the three factors. So I think the state's issue is more about the evidence itself and less about the standard. I mean, because the standard is what it is, and the court articulated the standard in its ruling and then applied the evidence that Dr. Jones-Forrester had presented. So,
Ms. Westbrook, sorry, let me interrupt you. Something that has bothered me in reviewing this record and preparing for today is on the one hand, we have the Dusky standard, which we've all been talking about. And in a different context, we have the Atkins case and NRS 174.098, which, of course, is different context and talks about death penalty and being subject to death penalty. And in that context, intellectually disabled means significant sub-average general intellectual functioning, which exists concurrently with deficits in adaptive behavior and manifested during the developmental period. When that finding is made, a defendant can't be subject to the death penalty, but can still be tried for murder and still be subject to life in prison, right? And my question is, would someone who is intellectually disabled under this standard be competent?
I think somebody intellectually disabled under which standard? Under Atkins?
Correct. If someone who would fall under, like, this statute provides that the consequence of this finding is that they can't be subject to the death penalty. But what I'm saying is, would that same person be considered competent given the analysis you're providing of what it means to be competent?
Well, I think it's up to the district court to make that determination. So you could be not subject to the death penalty, but competent enough to stand trial. It just depends on whether the district court makes that determination and looks at the evidence. In this case, we had a witness, an expert witness, that testified specifically that he does not have what it takes to understand what's going on in the context of court. He can't consult with his attorney. He is just not capable, and he's not capable of learning.
Right.
That's not the same type of testimony that you would, I mean, it may be related to the testimony that would be given at an Atkins hearing, but I think it's different. And the district court is free to make that determination and weigh the evidence and come to the conclusion. Because it's an evidence-based issue.
I'd like to intervene there if you had finished your answer to Justice Kadish's question. when I reviewed this record in this case, the thing that stood out to me was that Dr. Jones-Forrester's testimony and the judge's conclusions seemed to heighten the expectation of the defendant's understanding beyond what I'm accustomed to seeing, or I've seen in other records in this court and in the district court when I was sitting as a judge. I don't believe we have expected defendants to understand rules of evidence or be able to tell their lawyer when to object or those kinds of specifics. That seems to be what has happened here. And so the reason I posed the question I did to Mr. Chin is there a difference here where the testimony of Jones-Forrester provides to the doctor a heightened level of requirement for the determination of competency. If we begin to apply this standard, it seems to me that a wide number of defendants who in the criminal justice system suffer tremendously from mental deficiencies and learning disabilities will now become incompetent because the expectation of their competency is that they have a heightened level of being able to understand the legal proceedings, communicate with their lawyer, and get into very specific weeds regarding the trial of the case. I don't think that's the standard.
And I would say I don't think that's what the court found or what the expert was testifying to in this case. And I don't think that's necessarily going to be the result. If the court affirms in this case, well, all the court
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I'll ask you to go on with what you were saying after I add this. The court said, I think part of the assistance of counsel issue is that, you know, we have people who are trained to be medical professionals and mental health professionals, they are not trial lawyers, right? So I think sometimes that it's a difficult prong for them to evaluate, because if somebody can interact with them in a particular setting, it doesn't necessarily translate to what a trial is like, right? Because they're very, very, you know, chaotic. And that statement was in the context of the degree to which the defendant is to assist their counsel.
I understood that statement to be more in the context of differentiating between the environment in Stein, where mm-hmm. you have doctors that are reading showing pictures to the defendant because he can't read, and utilizing language and terms that are at a very, very low level in order to get the defendant to understand, and contrasting that with a trial experience that is not going to be at the level that the defendant is at. And he is at a very, very low level in this case.
So, okay, let's accept that point. But where is the finding that says we're going to dismiss the case without prejudice? He's not capable of restoring competency. Where's the evidence that supports that conclusion?
So as to whether there was substantial probability he would attain competence in the foreseeable future, Dr. Jones-Forrester testified that his conditions were lifelong, not amenable to restoration. Mm-hmm. She did not believe that he had ever actually been competent when he had been parroting back what mm-hmm. they had told him. So I think the court could rely on that portion of the neuropsych as evidence that he didn't have the capability to become to be restored. The restoration for this individual just simply wasn't possible.
Well, so the other aspect of this issue that I thought was unique and why I was interested, and I know my colleagues were, in having the case argued, is what does the judge do when faced with that issue? What must the judge find in order to conclude that they're not capable of restoration? Is it the same kind of neurological opinion and we leave it at that? Because if we're talking about the district judge makes the decision, this is not reviewable, and I suspect we're going to have a host of divergent outcomes depending upon who the district judge is that's sitting in the competency chair.
I mean, you may very well, because it is up to the district court to determine mm-hmm. what is necessary for that Dusky standard to be met. And as as the Dusky case indicated, we can consider a wide range of evidence. And actually that was not in Dusky, but more in the Calvin decision. Mm-hmm. The court explained that accuracy is best served when the district court and appointed experts consider a wide scope of relevant evidence at every stage. So it really is kind of up to the district court to, and how the court feels about that evidence. And that's how we've always treated it. Mm-hmm. I don't see an affirmance in this case doesn't mean that in every case where Sharon Jones-Forrester testifies and comes to this conclusion that the court has to agree with her. The standard of review on appeal is whether there is substantial evidence in the record to support the district court's findings. And in this case, that evidence existed and the court should affirm. Thank you.
Questions?
I do, Chief, but I think Justice Cage is just
yes.
I think it's a short question.
Yes.
Mr. Chen mentioned that this particular defendant actually has had a valid driver's license, which means they must have taken the written driving test, passed that, done the actual driving test, and passed that. Is that accurate to your knowledge?
I honestly, I can't speak to that, and I don't know if he actually took the, maybe somebody I don't know how that was taken.
Okay. So. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, hold on, Ms. Westbrook. So, and I apologize to my colleagues. Mine is two parts, and it might have a little bit of a longer answer. But the first question is, how often in your experience do the state doctors, Stein doctors, for instance, ask to observe the attorney-client interactions as part of their process in your understanding?
I am not familiar with them doing that. And I know in this case it was offered to them and they said that they weren't interested.
Yeah, I didn't think that was, I thought that that was unusual. And here's my concern. Obviously, Dr. Jones-Forrester observes the attorney-client interactions, and it seems that Judge Bell relied upon that, as well as pointing out that the Stein doctors didn't do it. Do you have any concerns as a criminal defense attorney that if the Stein doctors start making those observations and then using that against your client in terms of finding them competent and or placing you in the position potentially of having to testify at a challenge hearing about your interactions with your client and how the doctors maybe got that wrong? It just seems like a road that we don't want to go down in terms of Alice in the rabbit hole.
I mean, it may not necessarily be required in every case, but if an attorney wants to sit down with the Stein doctors and show them, you know, I think if counsel and the defendant all agreed, it could be done.
Right.
Any other questions?
No, thank you.
All right. Mr. Chin, I'm going to give you your full 3 minutes since we drilled you a little and offered your opposing counsel some additional time.
Thank you, Chief Judge. I do want to go back to this issue of IQ for just a moment. I think Justice Cage was the one who asked me about it when I was first arguing, and about what role that plays in this whole proceeding. And as I mentioned, I didn't think it was something that should be objected to. I thought it was something that the court considered, but I do believe the court got it wrong in the emphasis that it put, because this is a case where, objectively speaking, the defendant was able to answer the questions that were posed to him with regards to the Dusky standards. As even Jones-Forrester agrees when she was testifying, Stein did a lot of things right, and one of the things that they did correctly was they used the Slater method. The Slater method is specifically used for individuals who seem to have intellectual disabilities, and it's a tool they use to help those people attain competency. It is not a mock trial, for instance. So when Judge Bell talks about, well, trials are stressful and all the things that happen in trial that can't possibly be replicated, well, then what's the point of the Slater method, period? What's the point of competency restoration if our test is going to be that the individual has to be savvy enough to understand everything that's happening in court?
Well, where would we draw the line, though, on that issue of accommodations, right? I know that was one of the state's positions, and it was one of Judge Bell's concerns. I mean, you can't turn every three-day trial into a three-month trial because somebody needs so many accommodations to just be able to get through a proceeding.
Well, I think in this case, again, even from Dr. Jones-Forrester's opinions, he said that if there were questions, he would write them down and he would ask his attorney. There would be periods where he could ask those questions, and I believe I said in my...
Is he capable of writing words?
If he's
I thought
not,
he was illiterate. I mean, that was my understanding of the record.
And that's fair that he is. He does say, though, he would let his attorney know if something happened or someone said something that isn't correct, he would let his attorney know. And I apologize if I mix this one up with the other
okay.
one, but in terms of, you're absolutely right. And Justice Cage, just so you know, the driving matters were in Appellate Index 37, as well as...
Sorry, say that again?
Appendix 37.
Okay, thank you.
And that's actually just one reference to it. The other reference to it is that he had the wherewithal. This individual, again, competent enough to have the wherewithal that he can't read, he can't write. So he actually took someone, he had someone apparently take the test for him. And I say that not as a matter, and this is what's written in the psychological evaluations. Now, I'm not saying that to say he's a bad person for doing so. I'm simply saying that his competence level is that of someone who can be held responsible for his actions. And that's my ultimate point there.
Are you saying that he had someone else take the driver's test for him?
He said that he had somebody else take the driver's test.
So that cunning you think is significant in terms of his competence?
I do.
Yes, I get your point. Okay,
I do.
Thank you.
So basically, I just wanted to conclude with, this was the gravest sanction, if you will, that you could impose upon an individual or could impose upon the state by dismissing this case when you have an individual who at least understood why he was in court and the behavior that got him there. And for that, I do believe the district court abuses discretion.
Okay, thank you. Counsel, thank you for your briefing and your arguments. The matter will stand submitted.